the Department of Revenue on our agenda this morning. Senate File 869 is the Department of Revenue technical bill, and we have some folks from the Department of Revenue that will introduce the provisions of that bill, and then we'll take up Senate File 870, which is the policy non-budget bill, and I think we're going to plan to roll them into an omnibus bill along with some other policy work that the committee is interested in doing. So we'll take up Senate File 869 first. Mr. Mossman from the Department of Revenue is here to introduce that bill to the members.
Madam Chair and members, Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue. Thank you and for introducing, first of all, Madam Chair and carrying our department bills, both the technical and the policy bills. We appreciate the opportunity to bring these provisions forward. I know we want to work through the provisions in good time, and what we hope to do here from the department's perspective is I'm really just going to, you know, make these introductory comments, and what we'll do is we'll have, as is typical, have the legal staff who are most familiar with these provisions walk through the individual provisions, and we can take questions, whatever is your preference, as we go along. So with that, again, we appreciate the time this morning, and we'll start, obviously, with the technical bill, and we'll have Mr. Peterson start with the income tax-related provisions.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. We'll go through Article 1. Sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 7 all relate to the decision in 2010 not to conform to a special five-year net operating loss provision that Congress passed in late 2009. That federal law allows individual income tax filers to carry back net operating losses generated in 2008 or 2009 for 3, 4, or 5 years rather than the regular 2 years. In 2010, Minnesota decided not to conform to that and instead created a 2-year carryback for those losses with a 20-year carry forward. This was the first time in at least 25 years that Minnesota has not fully conformed to net operating loss rules as they relate to individual income tax filers. And these changes here will clarify how the losses are calculated and claimed for Minnesota purposes. The change in Section 1 just says requires taxpayers to add back to income the deductions that they took federally as a result of these net operating losses. Section 2 allows the taxpayers to claim a subtraction for their Minnesota-only net operating loss. Section 3 modifies the non-resident formula, the percentage they use to calculate their tax, by saying back out the effect of the federal NOL and put into the calculation the state NOL. Section 4 does the same thing for the alternative minimum tax, back out the effect of the federal NOL and include the effect of the state NOL. And Section 7 clarifies that taxpayers are allowed to use their full Minnesota NOL to offset their alternative minimum tax. Section 2 also makes another change to the subtraction for active duty military pay for service outside Minnesota by clarifying that taxpayers are allowed to subtract it once and only once. There's some ambiguity in the statute that makes it look like they can subtract it twice. This clarifies that. It does so in a way that the law will now have 3 distinct subtractions, one for reserve National Guard pay, one for active duty pay of a military resident, and another for active duty pay of a non-resident. Again, nothing substantive with this. And Sections 5 and 6 make a clarification in the Job Z minimum fee benefit by clarifying that it's only available to qualified businesses that operate in the zone pursuant to a business subsidy agreement. It's not available for someone like a business that is a lawn care business that sends employees out to mow the lawn of a qualified business. You have to have a business subsidy agreement to be able to get the benefit, and this clarifies that. That's Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Starica?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Lance Starica with the Department of Revenue. Well, I'll go through Article 2. The first section in Article 2 just corrects an incorrect Crofts reference in the tax relief for destroyed property statute. Second section makes a couple of changes. The first change is to add someone to the list of eligible relatives who can occupy the property and have it qualify as a residential homestead. The list of eligible occupants will be parents, siblings, children, or grandchildren. Right now, the only relative left out is the parent of a spouse of the owner. This change, along with a change in the next section, will make these different lists of which relatives qualify more consistent for us, and we think that'll be helpful. Second change in section 2 deletes a sentence so that two married people can still get their each get their own homestead under the four currently listed conditions, even if they didn't previously occupy the property together. Section 3 goes into the special agricultural homesteads, which are based not on the fact that you're living there, but that you're farming it. The first change just clarifies that in coming to the 40-acre minimum, that includes both the 2A and the 2B lands. The second change adds parents to this list of relatives. This is a slight change. This provision first came into being so that the parent, when the parents moved to town, the children could farm the land. It will continue to be a homestead.
Oh, okay.
This adds parents to that list, which is kind of a twist on that policy. But again, when we try to explain people how to get homesteads, there's 12, 13 different ways, and we think it would be helpful to have those lists of relatives be the same. The final change is a technical change just to maintain current law. Sections 4, 5, and 6 have to do with use deeds, which is state-owned property that is made available to local units of government for some purpose. In the first section 4, we're amending the definition of a park. Right now, that definition includes the words amenities, and we think that's a little bit of a weak word for the requirements, which really are that the property must be improved with benches, park. Picnic tables and things like that. The second section 5, we're changing two paragraphs the first paragraph clarifies that all deeds are subject to reversion if they're not used, but the exception where the property will not revert, even though it's not being put to use, as long as it's in a formal plan, that safe harbor is being limited to 15 years. Paragraphs B and C are not being changed. Paragraph D is being changed also so that the releases of these deeds after 2015 or after 30 years, whichever comes first, that's effective for all use deeds, not just the ones that were issued after the changes of last year. If there are any questions about that, I'd be glad to go back over it. Section 7 adds some deeds to the ones that are subject to the $25 administrative preparation fee. One of the things that happened in last year was we added more different alternatives for how these properties would be, the conditions under which they would be conveyed to local units of government. All of those new conditions weren't covered by the old deed fee statute, the current deed fee statute. Section 8 is just a clarification that any of the conveyances we do of tax forfeited land will reserve the minerals to the state. Previously, or currently, it just says for a sale. But again, some of the conveyances we have are other than what would typically be called a sale. The repealer does three separate things. The first thing is to eliminate a redundant qualification statute. The main statute for exemptions and property tax is 272.02. One of the limits says that the exemptions in one subdivision 1 to 33, of which there are now like 96, are governed by some other provisions. That statement is already appears in subdivision 1A of the statute, so this subdivision 34 is redundant. Excuse me. The second part of the repealer gets rid of a provision that allows people to have homestead even if they're prevented from occupying their newly purchased property on January 2nd. We've now got a generic provision that covers anybody who establishes a homestead by December, so this subdivision is no longer needed. And the final part of the repealer is an interest rate provision that's been in there since what I call ancient times. It's in conflict with the more current and comprehensive interest rate statute that we have in Chapter 279. That's Article 2.
Thank you, Mr. Sturica. Ms. Berry, if I could just let folks know, we have in Article 3, Section 2, a provision that has become pretty controversial, and I will be making a motion when we have sufficient folks here to vote on a motion to take out Section 2, and so I would ask you to please spend a little extra time on that provision explaining what it does and what the controversy is, if you're aware of it. And when we're done with the entire description of the bill, folks, we will then take testimony, if necessary, on any of the provisions that folks have concerns about. But for now, we're just going to have the overview from the department, and then we'll take up specific provisions following that. So with that, Ms. Berry, Article 3.
Section 1 is a small change. It's deleting a comma and adding a semicolon, thereby clarifying that the delivery of concrete block by a third party, where the delivery would be subject to sales tax if provided by the seller of the concrete block, is not excluded from the sales tax. Section 2, then, is the provision on the installation of computer software. We've added language which we think makes explicit what installation means for the purposes of pre-written computer software to show that it includes all of the steps that are necessary to take the software from the distribution files to where it's executed. And it's our position that this provision follows the current rules and our administrative practice. It's also consistent with the revenue notices that we've done several years ago and in our sales tax fact sheets. It's also very consistent with dictionary definitions. There's a computing dictionary which use some of the same language that you'll find in the bill. But as you stated, Madam Chair, there has been some controversy surrounding this provision in that there have been some people who have said that they think that the law doesn't support it. I mean, we disagree with it, but that's their provision, their position.
I don't mean to interrupt you further, but I just, for the record, want to note that there is a quorum present, and I would ask folks to stay so we can take up some of these amendments at the end of the introduction of this bill. Ms. Berry, I'm sorry for the interruption.
Okay, and then Section 3, then, it's the low-income housing provision. It's replacing an obsolete reference. Section 4 clarifies that the commissioner doesn't issue direct pay exemption certificates. Rather, the purchasers will designate that status on a fully completed exemption certificate that they provide to retailers. And then finally, Section 5 amends the statute on motor vehicle sales tax to clarify that the state rate, which we look at when we compare another state's rate for reciprocity purposes, is the rate in that chapter and not in the sales tax chapter.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Mr. Garber. No, you're not Mr. Garber. You're Ms. Garber.
Forgive me. My name is Nicole Garber, and I'm with Revenue. I'll go over Article 4, Special Taxes. Section 1, 2, 3, and 7 deal with the petroleum tax debt service charge, and these sections explain that a portion of the surcharge is to be allocated to non-highway use, consistent with other gasoline taxes. And Section 296-6A, 18, Subdivision 9, which deals with computation of the tax, is repealed since the information is incorporated in the other sections. Section 4 deals with insurance. It adds a new subdivision that excludes payments from the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program from taxes and surcharges under Chapter 297I. Section 5 and 6 are mineral tax provisions. Section 5 deals with the production tax, guaranteed distribution, and just corrects two sites in Chapter 298. Section 6 amends Section 298-28, Subdivision 2, to clarify that excess money from taconite funds goes to cities and township located within the school district. That is Article 4. I'll go over Article 5 as well. That's a miscellaneous article. Section 1 amends Chapter 270C to clarify that the commissioner can prescribe the content and format of all forms required to be filed under law and administered by the commissioner. And the last section is the waiver authority dealing with Job Z. Clarifies that there is a single 60-day limitation period for taxpayers to request a waiver of the obligation to repay Job Z tax obligations. Right now there are two periods, but this is going to be combined into one, and it starts the day the assessment is made. That concludes the technical bill.
Thank you. Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair, we did have one minor technical amendment that we were requesting, just a striking in Section 270A.03. There's a reference to the sustainable forest tax payment, and that program, it's not a tax payment per se, so we were just requesting to strike the word tax so that it reads sustainable forest payment.
Thank you. Mr. Mossman, we are going to hand out the 0146 amendment, and I would offer that amendment at this time. It does exactly what you've asked, Mr. Mossman, that we make a clarification. It's on line 1.7 that we take out a tax payment. The word tax is deleted so that it's a sustainable forest payment to a claimant. And pretty, it's about as technical as we can get around here. So I would make a motion to adopt the 0146. Any questions, comments, or concerns about that amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Members, I previewed just a little earlier that I would like to take out Article 3, Section 2. Many of you are new. The past practice of the chairs, and Senator Pogue-Miller, correct me if I'm wrong, has been when these bills come forward, if people have concerns about some of these provisions, making them then controversial, then the chairs have always accorded the accommodation, really, to take those provisions out so they could be worked on, discussed outside of the committee room, because these bills are going to be proceeding to an omnibus bill that will be hopefully non-controversial. It'll be a policy bill. Hopefully we can all work together to adopt a policy plan for the state of Minnesota with these technical and policy changes. And so if there are provisions in these bills that are of concern to you, we can take them out now, and members would be encouraged to work on them outside of the room if they want them to proceed. And so I would offer an oral amendment at this point to delete Article 3, Section 2, which is the computer software installation provisions. And we're going to hear from the Department of Revenue about why they think that that should be included in the bill. And we're also going to hear from folks about why it should be excluded from the bill. And then we'll take up the amendment at that time. And there may be others as well. I had one that I have questions on. But we'll take up that oral amendment at this time. So, again, to restate the motion before the committee, it would be to delete Article 3, Section 2. Mr. Mossman, do you want to address that?
Sure. Madam Chair and members, we certainly want you to be comfortable with the bill, obviously, and be comfortable that folks find this technical. We do feel that this is a technical provision, and we have been implementing the law. It has been our practice define installation, and as a practical matter, implement installation for pre-written software in this manner. I know that there has been some ongoing conversation, with folks in the industry. But I think from our standpoint, this language is, and I'll let Ms. Reisdorf can go into more of the history, but the words of the, I think you'd find that the words are very closely tied to what is already in existing revenue estimates the definition of installation, the dictionary definition of installation, and the law. So we feel pretty comfortable that it's tightly written technical language that reflects what we've already and will continue to be doing, even if the language comes out of the bill.
Mr. Mossman, do you expect that there would be a very broad application? Because when I read the provision, I think there's a huge application of this language to Minnesotans and businesses.
Madam Chair, good question, and I actually am going to ask Ms. Reisdorf to join in, because I think we do feel that it is consistent with how we're already interpreting the law and have been.
Welcome, Ms. Reisdorf.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Margaret Reisdorf. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And right now, the state of Minnesota, our sales price definition includes installation. So installation is part of sales price, and that includes taxable items like computer software. What we found administratively is, because installation is not defined, there has been confusion in the industry about what aspects of implementing, especially enterprise computer software, constitutes installation. So really the want for more detail and more definition has come from the industry. And so what we did when we crafted this definition is we looked at empirical information from computing resources like the Oxford Computing Dictionary, as well as our own publications that have been out there, specifically Revenue Notice 2006-11 and our rule, which is Minnesota Rule 8130.9910. So we started with an empirical industry definition and then added more detail from our already existing publications to try to provide more clarity for taxpayers on this issue.
Ms. Reisdorf. Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair, really nothing more to add. You know, again, you know, obviously we want you and the committee to be comfortable. We do, I mean, our role here is to do the best possible job we can to implement what we believe to be the interpretation of the laws that are passed by the legislature. And so that's what we feel we're doing. And so, you know, the committee has to be comfortable with the language also. So,
well, one of the reasons why I'm concerned about it is to include labor. You know, and we don't ordinarily tax labor. And so now we're talking about taxing labor within what we call installation. And so I'm concerned about that. Ms. Reisdorf?
Well, it's installation. Like, we have a revenue notice on that topic. Installation is taxable. It is a part of sales price. So if it's taxable sale, installation will be part of the sales price to which the tax is applied.
Thank you. Are there folks here that would like to testify against this provision? Welcome, Ms. Larson, Mr. Hesse.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Briefly, we do not believe this is a technical change, and it does not belong in a technical bill. We believe that the definition of installation is greatly expanded from what is the current understanding of our members. It's currently under appeal. I think there's actually some litigation that's recently been filed, and we believe this is an expansion, a big tax increase on business-to-business professional services, and so we would appreciate it being taken out of the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Hesse?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I agree with Ms. Larson's comments. I think the issue here is expanding what's included in installation to other consulting and design services that are currently exempt. As you know, services aren't taxable in Minnesota unless they're enumerated in the statutes, and those services right now are not taxable. And it's the position of our members that this is a major change in the taxability of certain types of services that are provided to businesses. So, again, we would support your amendment to eliminate this from the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Carnival?
Just wanted to
Good morning. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Peter Lindstrom with the Minnesota High Tech Association. Just also wanted to get on the record to back up with what Mr. Hesse and Ms. Larson stated, that our members believe that this is a broadening of the sales tax, and where this area has previously been viewed as professional services, that this would be detrimental to our membership. Thank you.
Questions or comments from the committee, or are there other folks that would wish to testify? Senator Pogemiller.
Chair, Mr. Mossman, if labor is not included, what does installation consist of? What is taxable then? I take it, I was looking for the statute. I take it, I can't, the book isn't here, but apparently installation is taxable. And if you don't include labor, what's left?
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, and I'm happy to have Ms. Reisdorf join me at the table again, but installation generally is taxable. And my understanding here is that we're talking about installation, you know, with pre-written software, unless it's configured to... Right. To be operable, it's not really. I mean, you don't really have the software unless the software is working in your environment. I think that, though, just to reiterate, in terms of the integrity of the technical bill, the department really feels comfortable and wants to be on record as being clear with the committee that we only bring technical bills or technical provisions forward in the bill when we feel they're technical. So if it gets to be a point where it's concerning, obviously we would want that integrity of the bill to be consistent. And we do believe that this is the way that the law reads. But we want you to be comfortable with the bill.
Ms. Reisdorf?
Madam Chair, members, my name is Margaret Reisdorf, Minnesota Department of Revenue. Installation, typically, especially in situations where, and I'm going to speak from what I understand what happens in audit or in when we're looking at taxpayer situations. When we see software installations, specifically enterprise-wide computer software installations, so computer software that is going to meet the needs of an entire business enterprise, often multifaceted, lots of different goals and uses for that software. It starts out where the computer software is pre-written, but it has to be installed in a way to work with the hardware systems of the taxpayer or of the customer who purchased it, as well as meet the needs of the various departments in that taxpayer's business. And so that can involve the implementation of that can involve configuring and unpacking files, making choices about installing certain modules or inputs or not. And what we wanted to be clear in this definition is that installation includes all of those pieces. It used to be time again where you would get your software on a disk and you would insert it into your hard drive and hit execute, and that constituted installation. That isn't the case anymore. So the hope with this definition was to show or to illustrate that we are talking about all those configuring and discrete installation pieces that can be involved.
Ms. Reisdorf, doesn't this have the ultimate consequence of then taxing programming? Because that's what, when I look at subdivision 17C and paragraphs B, 2, and 3, you're talking about configuration services and programming. Is that the intent of the Department of Revenue to tax programming, computer programming services?
Madam Chair, I want to reiterate that, the intent of the Department of Revenue in this provision and the intent of the Department of Revenue generally is to implement the tax laws as we believe you have adopted them. And so part, I think the question here is what does the legislature and policymakers believe and feel they are taxing? And we're simply trying to implement what we think that to be the case. We're not trying to expand the law. We're not trying to change the law in any way in the technical bill by any means. So, I think installation is generally taxable under the sales tax code. Pre-written software is taxable under the sales tax code. And that's what we're working from. And so I'm not trying to avoid the question, but just to be clear that we're trying to implement what we believe the legislature and past governors collectively have enacted into laws, the sales tax code. And so I think part of the question is what do you want to have be taxable?
Mr. Mossman, can you just tell us about
where's
the status
installation
of the
taxable?
Lawsuit?
I can't find that.
Madam Chair, I'm not aware of one, and I believe that, no, I could not.
Ms. Reisdorf, maybe you do, since you're an attorney in the Department of Revenue?
I actually don't have any information on that at this time. It's very new.
Senator Pogemiller.
Where is installation taxable?
I can't find
sales price. Subdivision 7, sales price.
On the right-hand page.
It's included in the definition of sales price.
Senator Howe. We'll come back to Senator Pogemiller. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, could you explain to me where, in all cases, our installation, are we just talking about computer software, or because would a dishwasher installation be taxable, water softener? Has there been a change? When was the change in the tax code for installation? Because I thought there was some distinction if a product was installed in a home, let's say, and it became part of the fixed asset of the home, that it wasn't taxed.
Ms. Reisdorf?
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, this is Margaret Reisdorf, Minnesota Department of Revenue. Installation is part of the definition of sales price in the sales tax code. So if the purchase is subject to the sales tax and there are installation charges involved, those installation charges will be included in the base price to which the sales tax will apply. I'm not entirely sure about your dishwasher example, but that is the way the sales tax code does work.
Madam Chair, follow
up. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, I thought that if you were installing, let's say, a dishwasher into a home, and maybe that's changed, but that if it was going to be installed and installation was provided and it was sold as an installed product, then not only was the installation tax exempt, that the product was tax-exempt also. I mean...
Senate counsel might be able to answer that question.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I don't believe that's correct.
Yes.
And I think this provision with installation charges has been in effect for quite some time.
Sure.
We can double-check that, but I think that's been the law for quite a while.
Right.
Ms. Berry?
Yes, I'm trying to remember as well when it first came into law, but it's part of the definition of sales price. And,
right.
and not it came about because of the streamlined sales tax. It was one of those choices that a state could make. And I know that's not all states do tax installation charges, or if they're separately stated on the bill, then they don't charge them. But I'm not sure. I'm thinking, for some reason, 2005 is coming to my mind, but I don't know that that's accurate. And then also, if it's part of installing something for real property, that's not going to be taxable either, of course. It's just the installation of tangible personal property.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I was wondering about the same sort of issue as Senator Howe. And maybe I'm confusing, like, if somebody comes and provides a service for you, carpet cleaning or something, the materials they do, then it matters if they bill you separately for the materials, in which case you pay a sales tax. But if it's part of the service, then it's not taxed. But it doesn't work the same for a dishwasher or wash machine, where if they include the installation price, whether they include the installation price, free installation, or whether they charge you separately for it. In other words, if I buy a dishwasher and it's $500 and $80 for installation, whether it's billed separately or I'm just paying a $580 dishwasher free installation, I'm going to pay sales tax on it either way, you're saying.
Ms. Berry or Ms. Reisdorf, either one.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, that's correct.
Members, this is a pretty controversial provision in what is intended to be a technical bill. And I would hope that we would take this out. If others want to take this up at another time, I would encourage them to do that. But I don't think that it has a place in this bill. So without further comment or question, I would renew my motion to delete Article 3, Section 2 at this time. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment is adopted. Mr. Mossman, another question that I had, going through the summary, Article 4, Section 4, relates to Federal Employees Health Benefits Act. Can you explain why that's a technical provision? Because the way it is summarized seems to have new tax treatment for federal employees' health benefits.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Ms. Garber.
Madam Chair, under federal law, state taxation is preempted. It's already included in other provisions of tax. For example, the Minnesota CARE exempts it already. And even without it, we couldn't tax it because of the federal law.
So then this is just a clarification of
it's
what is current tax treatment.
Yes.
Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members related to Senate File 869? Other questions, comments, or folks from the audience that would like to speak either in favor or against any of the provisions in Senate File 869? And the chair, without objection, would like to lay over Senate File 869 for inclusion in a policy omnibus bill. Without objection, it will be laid over. Members, we also have a policy bill from the Department of Revenue. It is Senate File 870. And Mr. Mossman, if you would like to introduce that bill.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, the intent here, as has been, you know, a long history, is these are provisions that are not technically maintaining necessarily what is current law, but things that the department suggests that might, for policymakers to consider, that might make allow the law to work better based on our experience of administering these programs. And so these are the recommendations that we're bringing forward. And I believe, Madam Chair, we've shared some suggestions that have come in, some from the Bar Association and others, and so we have an amendment as well. And if whatever your preference is, we can talk about those suggested amendment changes as we go through the bill or wait till the end. It might be more helpful to talk about them as we go through. It's up to you.
Mr. Mossman, I'm only aware of one amendment at this point. If there are others, please let us know. But I'm only aware of one amendment at this point. But sometimes the summary generates questions that might concern a member, and so we'll just kind of take it from there. But,
sure. Madam Chair, sorry, one amendment, multiple, a few sections. That's what I should have referred to.
I see, and that's the 0322?
Correct, Madam Chair.
All right, we can just take that up at the end, I think, but we'll go through the summary if you don't mind, Mr. Mossman.
Absolutely.
So, Senate File 870.
We'll start with Mr. Peterson.
Before we leave the
Senator
other bill,
Pogler.
Before we leave the other bill, real quick, will there be a revenue change now based on the not being able to implement what the department considered technical language?
Mr. Mossman.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller, none of these provisions in either bill there is a revenue notice for both bills, estimate for both bills in the.
I'm talking about Section 3 that was just deleted. Section 2, I mean. Would that.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller,
okay.
There will be no revenue impact. No.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senate File 870, and Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, I'll go through Article 1. Sections 1, 3, 5, 6, 7, and 8 are all related provisions dealing with the estimated tax charge, which is often referred to as an estimated tax penalty. It's really calculated in the manner of a form of an interest for not making sufficient estimated tax payments during the course of the year. Section 1 allows the commissioner to abate the additional tax charge for reasonable cause in all instances. It's not clear right now under the law whether we can abate it, and sometimes we can, sometimes we can't. This would allow for the abatement of the ATC for reasonable cause. Sections 3, 5, 6, 7, and 8 all work together, and really is why we were proposing this, to try to define the ATC for all flow-through entities to be the same. Right now there's different rules for trusts, S-corporations, and partnerships, and what we're trying to do is to bring them all together, make it easier for us, and make it easier for taxpayers to comply. Sections 5 and 8 work together to move the S-corporations from the corporate estimated tax provisions to the same rules that apply to partnerships and trusts. The biggest change there is that partnerships and trusts have been allowed to make estimated payments based on 90% of current year liability, whereas corporations have to make estimated payments on 100% of liability. The change will allow the S-corps to make the payments based on 90% of current year liability. Section 5 also clarifies what estimated taxes have to be based on, makes it clear that it applies to the sum of the minimum fee plus non-resident withholding and tax paid under composite return for non-residents. Section 3 is sort of a conforming technical provision that says that if a non-resident is paying tax on a composite return, they don't have to make estimated tax payments in their own capacity. That's done at the entity level. Section 6 makes a first-year exception from the ATC applicable to flow-through entities. The first year you're paying tax, you don't have to pay estimated tax. That's a provision that already applies to trusts and to individuals. And Section 7 just adds a provision that clarifies how taxpayers, primarily trusts, have to make estimated payments when they have a tax year that's shorter than 12 months. Section 2 is a relatively minor change related to active duty military pay. Minnesota residents with active duty pay for services outside Minnesota are not required to file a return if, after they subtract out their military pay, the result is zero Minnesota tax liability. This would say that if they're serving inside Minnesota active duty and their liability gets reduced to zero after subtracting out their active duty pay for serving in Minnesota, they don't have to file a return. It doesn't change anybody's tax liability. It's just whether or not they have to file a return. Section 4's withholding tax provision. Under current law, some third-party payers of sick pay can elect to withhold taxes from the sick pay and remit it under their own withholding account. So an employer has somebody else administer their sick pay program for them. This third-party payer then can elect to provide all of to withhold from the sick pay and then send the withholding to the Department of Revenue under their own account number. Then, though, at the end of the year, they give the information to the employer, and the employer gives out one W-2 to the employee that shows all the pay during the year, all the sick pay during the year, and all the withholding, both from the employer and from the sick pay. There's no problem. It makes it easy for the taxpayer to file a return. The problem comes in when the employer files the annual summary of their withholding, and they show that they've issued withholding W-2s that show $1,000 of taxes withheld, but it doesn't balance with the amount of tax that they've actually withheld to us. They've only sent in $900. Well, we start asking them, what's the problem here? It comes up on audit, and it's a relatively easy audit. They explain, well, we had the withholding under this other account. But what we think that that's a waste of our time, and we think it's a waste of the business's time. So to help clarify that, streamline that, make it easier, what we're proposing is that these third-party payors, only in those instances where they give the information to the employee, they've sent it in on our behalf under their own account, what they'd be required to do is file a report with us that says, we withheld on account of these employers, these five employers, and we withheld for these employees of those employers. We think that this is going to make it a lot easier for us to administer. The businesses won't have to go through audits. We'll be able to do those matches and figure out what's going on without ever having to contact the taxpayers or the employers. Yes.
It is, though, a new state requirement then for employers to make payments to folks for sick pay that they now have a new reporting requirement on March 1 of every year.
Madam Chair, it would be a limited, you're correct, it's a new reporting requirement only for those third-party payors. It's not for the actual employers who actually will like this, I would think, because otherwise they get an audit notice from us telling us to explain. So it's these third-party payors of sick pay who will be required to give us the information up front rather than have it done through audit.
Thank you.
Section 9 clarifies that the backup withholding, which generally applies when payers make payments without obtaining a tax identification number, applies in those situations where the payments are being made to independent contractors that are subject to the 2% withholding on independent contractors in the construction trades. This will only apply when the backup withholding is required federally, and the backup withholding then is done at the highest individual income tax rate of 7.85%.
Mr. Peterson, about that that's a change now. Does it change the amount of the backup withholding for these employers?
Madam Chair, no. The backup withholding has always been, when it applies, it's always been at the highest state rate. What this does, prior to the imposition of the 2% withholding on contractor pay, there's no doubt that this would have applied in these instances when the payor did not get the Social Security number or tax identification number of the contractor. When that law got changed, there got to be uncertainty over whether or not the backup withholding still applied at all. And this clarifies that the backup withholding does apply in these situations.
Thank you. Ms. Ryan?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Ryan. I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'll be discussing Article 2. For most of 2010, you may know that it appeared the federal government would not be imposing a federal estate tax on 2010 decedents. In December 2010, that changed, and a federal law was passed that imposes a federal estate tax on those decedents while allowing estates to opt out of the federal tax. While Minnesota's estate tax stands alone, our calculation does begin with the federal taxable estate, and so Article 2 proposes some changes to our estate tax laws in light of the federal changes. Section 1 extends the Minnesota estate tax filing due date for 2010 decedents to match the corresponding federal filing extension. Section 3 clarifies the Minnesota standalone Q-tip election. A Q-tip election is an election to treat property that would not otherwise qualify for the marital deduction as qualifying for the marital deduction. Usually, taxpayers make a Q-tip election on their federally filed returns, and Minnesota follows that election then on the Minnesota return. But last session, when there was no 2010 federal law or federal estate tax, a standalone Q-tip election was created to ensure that Minnesota filers would still have access to the Q-tip election. Now that the federal estate tax is back, we'd like to make a clarification to that Minnesota standalone Q-tip election. So it would provide that if an estate opts out of the federal estate tax, meaning they have no opportunity to make that Q-tip election federally, then they can make the standalone Q-tip election as provided by Minnesota law. All other estates can file a federal estate tax return, make the Q-tip election there, and then Minnesota will follow the election that's made federally. Sections 2 and 4 work to extend the audit period for the Minnesota estate tax. Right now, that period is 180 days after a complete return is filed. And we would propose that the audit period be extended to 3.5 years after the return is filed. This makes our audit period more in line with the federal period and the period for other states that impose an estate tax. We have been in discussions with the Bar Association about this proposal, and while they recognize our need to extend our audit period, they did have some concerns that we've addressed in amendment, I believe you said 0322, and I can talk about those when you pick that amendment up.
Thank you. Ms. Sims?
Yes, my name is Harriet Sims from the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And I am going to talk about Article 3, the property tax amendment, beginning with sections 1, 2, and 5 through 8 all deal with the same topic and work together. Collectively, these allow the department additional time to either issue a corrected certification of railroad utility and wind energy production tax valuations to counties, or in the case of recommended values, our intent is that that would allow the commissioner to additional time to notify the counties of what our recommended value is. So generally these would be before the counties would have enough time to send out their notices. And their other changes are technical and update cross references. In section 3 deals with homesteads, and that is a case to clarify a provision that was enacted in 2010, and there are four clarifications made. First is that the provision grants a class rate benefit. In other words, it doesn't create another homestead. In the case of the homestead, it also clarified that it covers both the 2A land, which is its actual farmed land, and then 2B land, which is rural vacant land. The homestead has to be owner-occupied, and it only applies to the additional non-homesteaded property, and it is effective for taxes payable in 2011 and thereafter. Section 4 makes a slight adjustment to agricultural homesteads to treat intensive livestock confinement operations as an agricultural use, regardless of their size. So it would be targeting significant agricultural operations that are actually occurring. And we believe that this is what was intended.
Thank you, Ms. Sims. Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair. Article 4, Sales and Use Tax Article. The first section concerns accelerated monthly payment and provides an additional safe harbor. During the 2010 legislative session, a law was enacted so that those retailers who are already paying the June accelerated tax would pay accelerated monthly. And they had a couple of options. And one of those options was that by the 20th of the same month in which the taxable event occurred, they could remit an amount equal to 67% from the previous month's liability. And then the remainder would be paid on the 20th of the following month. Well, there's penalty for underpayment, and this new provision would provide an additional safe harbor so that the penalty would not be imposed if the amount remitted is equal to the liability for the month in which the taxable event occurred. The way it's currently written, they could be taxed, even though if they may have paid less than the 67%, but it was actually equal or greater to the actual liability for the month, under the current language, they could be penalized. So this takes care of that.
Ms. Berry, I wonder if Senator Daley wants to say what I'm thinking, because he just gave me that look. Senator Daley?
No, go ahead.
I just don't know how we could make this any more complicated. This is horribly complicated, and I'm not sure this is an improvement, are you?
Oh, this is if this provision is going to remain in here, this is definitely a provision, Madam Chair.
Can you explain how this is an improvement? Because it's just I'm lost in the complexity of it, I'll be honest.
Madam Chair, and then I'll turn it back over to Ms. Berry. Obviously, as you are familiar, I think that this was done for cash flow purposes, this language generally. And so what's happening here is that I think the long and short of it is that what's getting caught up in the provision is that if you're a seasonal business, particularly, that has revenues in one period of time and then they fall off, the safe harbor might not be working for you in the way that was intended, or it might not be working for you at all. So this is an effort, if it remains in law, in order to make sure that it works for all businesses that are cyclical or even that have a continuous.
Mr. Mossman, wouldn't it just be better to just deal with this in a straightforward way? And I know that
that it has revenue impact, but we seem to be trying to fix a problem that we've created, and we just keep making it more and more complicated. Maybe this does help some of those seasonal folks, but I'm just struck by how complicated this is, and I wonder what we're doing here. Does it, beyond the seasonal businesses, does this have an impact on Minnesota businesses, this new change?
Well, Madam Chair, I think we're primarily talking about the seasonal businesses. But the thing is that right now we are caught in the situation where we're having to look at abating these penalties because people are getting caught in this. There are taxpayers that are actually paying more than what their liability is. I mean, there is a provision in there which allows them a credit. If you paid more than your liability, you will get a credit, but you're also being penalized because you paid less than that 67% from the previous month. And we just don't think that's right. People shouldn't be penalized because they paid more than their liability. So this sets that straight, makes it fair.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. Members, Senator Howell has a bill that addresses this, and I'm hoping that we're going to give that bill a hearing after our break, and hopefully we can address the issue on a comprehensive basis. I know you're doing what you can to help businesses who are dealing with these provisions, and you're trying to help here. I acknowledge that. I just think we should have a more comprehensive approach, and so we'll have more of a hearing when Senator Howe's bill is before us. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mossman, what would it cost to buy back this shift? What are we at, a 90% shift right now? What would it, if the tax committee had a little one-time money sitting around here in one of the coming months, what would it cost us to buy this off?
Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, you're catching me a little bit. I'm not entirely sure. My recollection is that it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $130 million, but I really would want to verify that and get back to you.
Madam Chair, maybe to Council, are we at 90%?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Bach, it is the 90% requirement now, and that's on a number of different taxes too, not just the sales tax.
Thank you. Ms. Berry.
Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 provide language to help Minnesota stay in conformity with the streamlined sales and use tax agreement that Minnesota has participated in since 2002. Sections 1 and 2 provide transitional language for taxable services where there's a tax rate change and the service covers a period beginning before and ending after the effective date of the rate change. Sections 3 and 4 deal with sales tax sourcing for direct mail. We already have a provision in law for direct mail. This amends that so that we create separate categories, one for advertising and promotional direct mail and another for other direct mail. And the advertising and promotional direct mail that remains in the state would be taxable in Minnesota. If it's delivered out of state, it would not be taxable in Minnesota. I mean, that's the same as it is now. And I would also point out that that sections 1, 2, 3, and 4 were already heard, I believe, by this body in Senate File 1006 that Senator Chamberlain brought forth. Section 6 amends the session law to clarify that a St. Paul lodging tax on lodging establishments having 50 or more lodging rooms is based on the consideration furnished for both lodging and related services.
Ms. Berry, that one also was brought to my attention as one that would actually raise additional revenue in the city of St. Paul. They're saying that that was the intention of the provision in our session law, but it's not been the application. Can you just expand on that? Will that raise additional revenue in their city based on that lodging tax?
Well, that has been the application until recently. The Department of Revenue was looking at the ordinances and all the surrounding documents and realized that the session law didn't say and related services. So they had been taxing it on related services, but once we discovered that, and that's just, it was just in the last several months, we said that unless there was a law change enacted, we would not be able to continue to administer it in the same way. I believe that there are hotels and other lodging facilities right now that are probably are collecting the tax on both the lodge and the related services. I don't have any data to show, you know, whether that bears out or not. But in the future, I mean, if this law isn't passed, I mean, I think we're going to have to go with, you know, this is what the law says. It does, for this additional 3% for these 50 more lodging rooms, since the law doesn't say and related services, we think we're going to have to limit it to just lodging.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, what are the related services? I mean, is it separate rooms you're saying, in other words, when you say about the less than 50 lodging rooms, is it related to what we're calling lodging, or the related services, other taxes on other things like gym membership or whatever?
Ms. Berry?
Right. It would be related services related to the lodging. For example, if someone has, you know, like the television in their room where they have to pay for video or something like that, I mean, that would be related to the lodging. That would be an example. And Madam Chair, Senator Marty, under our sales tax law for lodging, you know, there's a sales tax on the lodging. We collect it on lodging and related services. So when the Department of Revenue administers a local tax, such as a lodging tax, the expectation is that we would administer it with a similar base. And since ours is lodging and related services, we would want theirs to be lodging and related services as well. There was a law that was enacted last year that said that for any special local law that's enacted for which the department will administer their tax, that it would have to have a base similar to ours. And so if this were to be enacted today, instead of just amending it, we would administer as if it was related services, even if the words weren't in there. So it'll be consistent with that new law as well.
Thank you. That helps. Have questions about that? Thank you, Ms. Berry.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sundjum.
Madam Chair, this particular section deals with St. Paul, but I'm trying to understand how this might apply to other cities. Or does it? Do other cities have this and related services provision, and St. Paul just did not? Or I'm not sure I'm being clear, but
Ms. Berry.
Well, first of all, Madam Chair, Senator, there are not that many cities,
right,
for which the Department of Revenue administers their lodging tax.
Okay.
There's a lot of cities that have lodging taxes, but most of them we don't administer. So we're comfortable with the way that the other ones are drafted as far as the administration of them. So.
Okay.
Thank you. All right, other questions about the sales and use taxes? If not, then we'll move on to Mr. Finnegan.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Pat Finnegan. I'm an attorney in the Revenue Department, and I'll go through Article 5, the miscellaneous article. Section 1 is related to the fire and police state aid payments. These payments are due October 1st. Under current law, if the payments are late, even one day, interest would accrue back to July 1st. So the proposal here is to change that date to October 1st. Section 2 deals with what information is required on an application for a Minnesota business tax account number, and it exempts the requirement for personal information if the entity applying is a governmental entity. Section 3 deals with rounding on tax forms. We already have the authority for rounding for income tax and for property tax refund returns. This would give the authority to the commissioner to require rounding on all tax returns. Section 4 relates to a third party's subpoena when there's a criminal investigation. The general rule would be that when a subpoena requiring production of records is served on a third party record keeper, written notice of the subpoena must be mailed to the taxpayer and to any other person who's identified in the subpoena. This would create an exception for subpoenas where we're involved in a criminal investigation, so that notice wouldn't be required under this subdivision, and the third-party record keeper would be prohibited from informing the taxpayer of the subpoena. Section 5.
Excuse me, Mr. Finnegan. Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, Mr. Finnegan, is that to protect the confidentiality of the investigation, so that in other words, if somebody's being investigated for criminal fraud or something, that they're not aware they're doing it right away? Or is it to protect from others finding out that somebody's under investigation?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, if this was requested by our criminal investigative division, and I believe it's just to assist them so that there's knowledge is not given to the taxpayer while the investigation is conducted.
And Mr. Finnegan, just criminal, not civil.
Yes, Madam Chair. Section 5 deals with service of subpoenas, and this would this provision would expressly allow the service of subpoenas by mail. Some banks have required personal service, and so we just wanted to clarify in the statute that subpoenas can be served through the mail. Section
Mr. Finnegan, excuse me. I think that that provision has been requested before, and we've talked about it here in this committee before. It's one that I've been concerned about. A subpoena isn't ordinarily served by mail in our courts, and so I'm concerned about that when others may or may not be concerned about it, but it's been brought to this committee before, and I don't believe it's been in the bills before. So what is the need for a mail subpoena as opposed to regular service as we would in all of our other court proceedings?
Madam Chair, I believe this was something that our collection division basically wanted, that it, for administrative ease, that they're involved with so many different subpoenas, and they do issue a lot of them by mail currently, but some banks have refused to honor them. So it's our position that we can already do this, so we'll just clarify that we have that authority to do it through the mail.
And would this include civil proceedings and not just and also criminal proceedings? Any subpoena could be served by mail on any party for any purpose?
This would be any subpoena, Madam Chair, yes. Section 6 relates to the authority to credit department payments. Currently, an overpayment of tax may be credited against a delinquent tax liability. And the proposal is to expand this authority so that basically we could apply any payments going out of the department to delinquent tax. Section 7 deals with the, it relates to the sale of seized personal property, and it would remove the requirement to physically post a notice at the county courthouse where the seizure was made. It would maintain the requirement for posting in at least three places, but it wouldn't have to be at the county where the seizure was made. Most of the sales that we have as far as seized property are done in Ramsey County. Section 8, currently the department is required to report quarterly to the legislature on the acquisition and sale of seized property. And this proposal would be to change the reporting requirement from quarterly to annually. We just don't have as many seizures as we had in the past. Section 9 it deals with the mortgage registration tax, and it sort of deals with a unique situation. The tax is paid is based on the amount of the debt that is secured by the mortgage. This is saying that if one secures a new debt, then the tax has to be paid. And I have the understanding that there is an amendment that the Bar Association has recommended some language change that deals with this issue. And then Section 10 is just a repealer dealing with the rounding provision that we discussed in Section 3. This repeals the specific language for rounding in income tax and property tax refunds, since Section 3 would cover those situations now.
Mr. Finnegan, Sections 5 and 7 aren't contained in the 0322 amendment or addressed in there. I just want to clarify before I proceed on those. I don't see them as part of that. I just want to make sure.
Madam Chair, no, the only amendment that I'm aware of that deals with Article 5 is in relation to Section 9.
Okay. Members, I am concerned about Sections 5 and Section 7 because we are talking about notice to folks affected by the department, and administrative ease for me is not one of the top concerns in this issue, making sure that folks have notice of the department's actions would be paramount. And I don't know if others feel the same way, but Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, on Section 7, I'm not sure if they're saying that's for ease as much as if most of the seizures are taking place in Ramsey County. If you live in Kitson County, posting it at the Ramsey County Courthouse doesn't strike me as a likely place. I mean, I don't know what these three public places they post them at, but I was going to say I'm not sure this is one that's for their ease as opposed to something else. And I hear your concern about the subpoena by mail. I mean, if they're doing that already, I don't know. No other subpoenas are done by mail?
Well, not generally, no. Unless there are folks, lawyers, that have already been engaged in the lawsuit or the legal proceedings, but the first notice would never be, or a first subpoena would never be provided by mail in any other court proceeding. Mr. Finnegan, about Section 7, notice of sale of seized property, could you just expand on the intention of the department on that provision?
Madam Chair, the intention there is just to remove the requirement to post a notice at the courthouse where the seizure was made for personal property. We would still be required to post notice of the seizure in three places, and we would probably normally do it on our department website, a newspaper. We could do it at a public library, at the courthouse where we're going to sell the property. It just would eliminate the need for us to, if we did a seizure out in a remote area, to go out there again and do the posting.
Mr. Finnegan, aren't there county employees or folks that can post in the courthouse on your behalf if you send them the notice?
Madam Chair, I believe it's possible. I'm not sure if do we normally mail this?
No. Madam Chair, my name is Wayne Sather from the Department of Revenue. No, we personally take the notices to the courthouses and post them ourselves.
So the Department of Revenue does a seizure of personal property in Coochie Ching County, and rather than call somebody up there, the Department of Revenue sends somebody up there to post at the courthouse?
If we do a posting, do we have to just mail it to them and have them do it, or over the phone?
Madam Chair, the problem with that is that the counties do not have any obligation to do that for us. And so if we mailed it to them, they could or could not post it at their own desire. we couldn't predict for certain that it would be posted.
That's a sad state of affairs, I'm just going to say.
Madam Chair, if I could just add, you know, I think your sentiment is well taken, that the intent here is to seek some efficiency given how things have changed. But it would nonetheless remain the department's obligation, obviously, to ensure that the posting occurs, which I think relative to Mr. Sather's point is, you know, what we're basically addressing here, that it's our obligation to make sure that the postings occur under the law. And so how can that be done?
Mr. Mossman, I think you have the wrong approach here. I'm not sure why you can't call the county auditors who issue all the property tax statements and provide all of their levy notices to the Department of Revenue and ask them to post all of your notices. I mean, instead of taking away the potential notice to people that are affected by your decisions to seize, I think you got the wrong approach here. And so I'm going to move that we take out sections 5 and 7. I hope the committee will help, and I hope that you'll take this back internally and work with these county auditors to post your notices. I think we're going in the wrong direction here. Other comments or questions about an oral amendment to delete from the bill Article 5, Section 5 and 7? Seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. Amendment is adopted. Thank you. We have an amendment, 0322. Mr. Mossman, would you like to explain the 0322?
Madam Chair, members, yes, thank you. Just by way of general introduction, the provisions largely in the 11-0322 are provisions that in looking Thanks. Through the bill, we've had a number of some suggestions from the Bar Association that we've worked through in a couple of different areas, and that's what's contained in the amendment. And the first one, I'll have Ms. Ryan go through all the way lines 1.2 all the way through 1.18 refer to a provision related to the estate tax.
Madam Chair, members of the committee,
Mr. Rossman, your voice went down. I didn't hear that last thing. Relate to
The estate tax.
The estate tax. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Jenny Ryan with the Department of Revenue. As I said earlier, the department is seeking an extension of the statute of limitations for assessment for estate tax returns. The Bar Association, we had a meeting with the Bar Association where they let us know that while they understand our need to extend that period of time, they are concerned about probate matters being unduly delayed. They would like to see probate matters be closed and assets distributed to beneficiaries as soon as possible. To deal with that concern federally, the IRS sends what's commonly referred to as a closing letter to estates about 9 months from the time a return is filed to those estates that are no longer under examination for audit. The closing letter is then relied on by personal representatives to go ahead and close probate and distribute those assets. And what we've done here by amending 289A35 is we've created a similar system here at the state of Minnesota so that the commissioner would, within 9 months of an estate tax return being filed, notify the estate as to whether the return is under examination or the return has been processed as filed. We would essentially be adopting that closing letter process.
Thank you. And Ms. Ryan, then that is complementary then to your change in the audit, the length of the audit from 180 days to 3.5 years, because then now we're going to let folks know whether you've got concerns or not.
Correct. We have shared this language with the Bar Association, and last we heard they were in agreement with the language, and all of these provisions, the statute of limitation and this closing letter process, would become effective for 2011 decedents.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Lance Tarica from the Department of Revenue again. The remainder of the 0322 amendment, lines 1.21 to 1.26, essentially replace what is in the policy bill as Article 5, Section 9. This was the provision on the mortgages having to do with amounts, new loans that were wrapped into an old mortgage. I could go through the language changes. This replacement, this new language was suggested by the real property section of the state bar. A number of words have changed. We've got fewer words in the new version. An added reference to the line of credits, an explicit reference to the line of credits where this is possible, is added, and essentially the same thing is being done with a little better language.
This is different.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped over a last-minute addition to the amendment. On lines 119 and 120, I apologize. That goes back to the provision where we're adding livestock confinement, Article 3, Section 4. We added some clarifying language to this section of the law where we were to change explicitly providing that livestock confinement areas are agricultural, even if the confinement itself isn't 10 acres. In that section of the law, having to do with the classification of agricultural land, we made a number of language changes clarifying things. One of the things we did was strike out the requirement that the land had to be used for agricultural purposes during the preceding year. Gets kind of complicated like some of these things do, but this isn't so bad. There's two concerns going on there. One is, one line of thought is we should not have an explicit requirement that the land actually be used in the preceding year, because you run into situations of injury, floods, letting the land set fallow, where you don't really want that, you don't want the assessor to be that strict. On the other hand, it's recently been brought to our attention, if you do strike that requirement, so now there is no requirement that it be used in the prior year, there is a concern that assessors will get too lax and leave the property, because of the significant tax difference, they will leave property classified as agricultural, even if it hasn't been farmed in, I don't know, 10 years. So we would like, we're asking in this amendment to leave that part of the statute the way it is. We will continue to work on that. We're not prepared today to say what those injury, flooding, you know, we're not prepared today with that list, because once you do have a list like that, then if something else comes up, you're precluded. So in this 1.19 and 1.2, we're asking to leave that part of the statute the way it is.
Thank you. Questions? Are there folks that would like to testify regarding 0322 amendment, either for or against any of the provisions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the 0322 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The 0322 is adopted. Now we are back to the 870. And without objection, I would like to lay over 870 for possible inclusion in a tax omnibus policy bill. Without objection, it's laid over. Members, just to give you an update on what's ahead, we will not have a tax committee tomorrow. The tax conference committee will meet for the first time tomorrow at 8 a.m. here in room 15. We'll be hearing some non-budget bills with no revenue estimates or impact after break. So we have several that have been requested, and so we'll be hearing those after break, and we'll send out those notices here by the end of the week to let folks know what's ahead. Without further business before the committee, we are adjourned.